The Joy of Texas is brought to you by JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. JOFA is a leader in advancing social change around gender issues in the Jewish Orthodox community. Visit JOFA.org for lots of great content, including webinars, blog posts, journals, halachic essays, and more. The Joy of Texas is also brought to you by Yeshivat Chovavei Torah Rabbinical School, which trains the next generation of modern Orthodox rabbis cultivating a love of Torah, a commitment to halacha, and the philosophy of inclusiveness. Now in its 14th year, YCT Rabbinical School has close to 100 rabbis serving in the Jewish community in the pulpit, college campuses, and Jewish day schools. Visit their website at yctorah.org.
Welcome to The Joy of Text, a podcast about Orthodox Judaism and sexuality. This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Today we will be discussing fantasy. What is it? How common is it? And is there room for it in an Orthodox relationship? We will then be joined by tonight's guest, Michael Lesher, author and expert on sexual abuse in the Orthodox community. And we will conclude tonight with questions written by listeners. With me to discuss these topics are Dr. Batsheva Marcus, the clinical director of the Medical Center for Female Sexuality. She is a founding member of the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. Rabbi Dov Linzer is the Rosh Yeshiva, the rabbinic dean of Yeshivat Chovavei Torah Rabbinical School, a modern Orthodox rabbinical ordination program, which is now in its 14th year, with close to 100 rabbis serving in the pulpit, college campuses, and Jewish day schools. My name is Rami Smith, and I am in my last year of study at Yeshivat Maharat. Dr. Marcus, can you please tell us a little bit about fantasy? When people hear fantasy, they might think of role-playing, but that's not what fantasy is. What is fantasy? Are there different kinds of fantasy, and how common is it?
Rami, thanks for asking. Fantasy is kind of an interesting topic because I feel like it makes everybody nervous. You start talking about fantasy, and people start sort of squinting at you. Fantasy is really the idea that you move into your head in any number of ways in order to sort of express your sex life, or at least sexual fantasy, which is what we're talking about today, right? Fantasy in general, you can be fantasizing about taking a boat ride, but the kind of fantasies we're discussing today or tonight are fantasies having to do with sex. And all having a fantasy means is moving into your head to be thinking about different aspects of sexuality. It makes people nervous because they don't quite understand it. They don't know how to do it. They think it might be wrong. They've heard all kinds of weird assumptions or halachic positions on fantasies. And the truth is that fantasies is a critically important part of a person's sexual life. The biggest sex organ that you have is your brain. And unless we learn how to use our brains to enjoy sex, it's a problem. So learning how to fantasize is a really important component.
Dr. Marcus, you mentioned that there are some halachic misnomers people might have about fantasy. Rabbi Linzer, I want to direct this at you. What might these halachic misnomers be, and are they founded or are they not founded?
Thank you, Rami, and thank you, Batsheva. In my experience, a lot of people know of a Gemara or of a Jewish idea or of halacha. It's not always about halacha per se, that if a woman is thinking about another man while she's having sex with her husband, it's like she's committing adultery. If a man is thinking about another woman while he's having sex with his wife, it's like he's committing adultery. And this actually is rooted in a passage in the Talmud, which states that a man is not supposed to be thinking of another woman while he's having sex with his wife. I think it's important to appreciate two things. The first is that the Talmud had a belief, almost a scientific belief of their time, that what a person was thinking about when one was having sex would actually determine and impact how the child would turn out. So if somebody was thinking about a certain man, then the child might actually take on some of the characteristics of that man that the woman was thinking about. So this obviously we know is not true, but this adds to that type of concern in the Talmud.
Is the Gemara is geared at a man thinking about a different woman, not a woman thinking about a different
man.
So
thank you for interrupting me on that. it's important that the Talmud is written by men, for men, and about men, although it addresses women. It's through the male lens. So when the Talmud speaks about what is a person thinking about, it basically means what is a man thinking about. However, in a famous passage, it says that Rabbi Yochanan would sit outside of the mikveh so that women that were leaving leaving the mikveh and going home to have sex with her husband would see him, and he was a very handsome man, and he said, this way they'll be thinking about me, and the kids will turn out to be as handsome as me and as scholarly as me. So here the Talmud was actually talking about what the woman was thinking about. But that passage already points to the fact that it's not always a problem to be thinking about someone else. Here Rabbi Yochanan wanted the women to be thinking about him.
And if I, can I interrupt for a second?
Please.
Because I think this is where people get so messed up when it comes to fantasies. You know, fantasies are not always about specific people. First of all, they tend to be about prototypes, right? So if a guy says, you know, like, well, always fantasizing about a certain movie star, I know Jennifer Aniston. So I would say he's not really fantasizing about Jennifer Aniston, right? He's fantasizing about a cute ditzy blonde. Do you know what I mean? Like, that is happens to be what's turning him on at the moment. So when we talk about fantasizing about other people, we don't usually mean other people. We mean sort of other ideas of people, things that we have in our head about other people. And I would additionally add to that that for most women, at least, fantasies are very broad-reaching. Like, if you talk to a woman, she says, I'm fantasizing about Derek Jeter. So Derek Jeter, it could be parts, his body parts that she's imagining. It could be his face. She could actually be having a baseball conversation because that really turns her on. Or it could be, Rabbi Linzer thinks that's very funny. Thank you, though. Or it could also be that it's not even, she doesn't, I've had so many women telling me there's no person in their fantasy. It's just a thing that's happening, a conversation that's going on.
A scenario.
Without even, they wouldn't even be able to describe to you who the person is. So I think we have to be really careful when we talk about fantasizing. We have to realize that different people fantasize in lots of different ways. It's not that somebody's fantasizing about the man who sits in the next cubicle. And I think that that reality is just changes the whole shape of what we think about when we think about fantasy.
Is one more common than the other? Is it more common for one to fantasize about a scenario than it is about a person? Is it different for men and women?
I'm sorry, Rami, I'm sorry if I could interrupt, because I'd like to, if I could just jump in there, because I think that, thank you, Batsheva, what that is critical in understanding also the halachic issues, because when the Talmud speaks about putting aside the issue about how it will affect how the child will turn out and that sort of science that they had, but when the Talmud speaks about the halachic problem of a man thinking about another woman, what the Talmud is talking about is the man is using his wife as a stand-in for somebody else that he really wants to be having sex with right now. And he's not relating to his wife in this act. He's imagining he's having sex with this other woman and he wants to be having sex with this other woman. That is what the Talmud sees as deeply problematic. Then it's not about connecting to your wife, about the man connecting to the wife. When it's about a type of type that you speak about, or an, you know, a movie star, and that's used to create arousal and stimulate and get, you know, get excited, but ultimately the act of sex is about, is between the man and between husband and wife, then that would not be a problem at all. And I think that that's the largest mistake that people make.
Great. I mean, Rami, you asked about what's like, what's typical? What do women think about? What do men think about? You know, there's just so little literature out there. There's just not a good body of evidence out there. We don't know. I'm dying to do some
Gemara's
studies on this.
Gemara's not a reliable book of literature on this.
Unfortunately, the Gemara is not a reliable book of literature. But, you know, I'm sort of keep thinking about the idea of actually doing some really deep research on fantasies. We don't know. But I will tell you for sure from the thousands of women I've worked with that the range is dramatic, that what one woman talks about fantasizing, another woman would like say, what, are you kidding me? That's not a fantasy, and that this is what I fantasize about. And that, you know, the person's face, the person's body parts, the interaction, the scene, where we are, remembering sort of snippets of things that happen, all of those things build into fantasies, and that really is a much broader range than we think about. My hunch is just from literature that in general men tend to be more visually based and women are more scenario-based, both when it comes to pornography, when it comes to literature, erotica. So I'm going to guess that that probably holds true for fantasies as well. But even then, I'm really not sure. There's no real good reliable research.
Rabbi Linzer, is there a difference halachically in fantasizing about a scenario versus fantasizing about a person? Are both halachically acceptable? Is one halachically acceptable?
I I don't know of any discussion in the Talmud about fantasizing about a scenario. I can't see what the problem would be about that. I think, as I said, the degree that the Talmud discusses it, it relates to a man thinking about another woman or a woman thinking about another man.
A specific
other man. And as we saw in the case with Rabbi Yochanan, here was a specific man that they actually saw. And nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan wanted them to be thinking of him. So one could only imagine that Rabbi Yochanan was not a man that any woman would have expected he was actually going to be having sex with, but it was enough to arouse her and to have her thinking about him in a fantasy type of a way, not in a way of substituting him for the man in front of her. I am curious, Batsheva, about how would you feel if a man came, if a man said to you, or said to his wife, I find myself, like, I'm really turned on by a woman I work with. You know, is it appropriate for me to be thinking about her while I'm having sex with my wife? Because here's where I think halacha would say no.
Right. So there, that's a really interesting question. I think if somebody says to me, again, there's a prototype, like, I'm attracted to this woman who works down the hall because she's very tall and athletic, or for whatever reason, I find that a big turn on, or she has, like, long, wild hair, and I find that a turn on. So that strikes me as not so problematic. If, on the other hand, somebody says to me, a woman says to me, I keep fantasizing about the guy who works two cubicles down. I have a lovely relationship with him, and I keep fantasizing about him. In that case, I'd say, whoa, let's talk about that. Let's figure out what's going on and what may be happening in a relationship or not happening in a relationship, and what's happening in the that particular context of that relationship. Because then I don't feel like it's a fantasy as much as it's within the context of a real relationship. And that, I feel like, that's when it starts becoming a little bit more problematic.
And how does that differ from Rabbi Yochanan? The woman, a few cubicles down versus seeing Rabbi Yochanan right outside of the mikvah and fantasizing about Rabbi Yochanan.
Seeing Rabbi Yochanan is bumping into
Derek Jeter
on the street. So it even when you see him in person, he only exists in a world of fantasy, not right. In any actual possible wish fulfillment. And I want to build on that, because I think it's even if one isn't thinking necessarily sexually. Let's say somebody is having sex with his wife or her husband and thinking about a charged conversation that he had with the woman he works with, or she had with the man he works with, you know, and like how she would, you know, how she was really turned on by having a conversation with him. I think that would be a problem.
So again, I feel like then the question becomes patterns. I look at patterns, right? Because the use of a charged conversation in order to make your sex life with your partner better, I say, great. Like, you're going to be married to the same person and having sex with the person for a long time. You're going to need lots of vehicles to make that fun and exciting. And so if somebody says something to you flirtatious, or you say something flirtatious, and it got you thinking the rest of that afternoon, and then you go home and you're with your partner and you're kind of playing that in your head, to my mind, that does not feel either problematic or dangerous. If you're having a regular ongoing flirtation with somebody, that feels very different to me.
Right. So I was actually talking about the latter case, and as far as an ongoing flirtation, so we're on the same page about that. And as far as the issue about something that occurs and then it excites the person, and then they go home. There's actually another fascinating passage in the Talmud that Rava had a court case, and Abaye's wife came to the court, and her arm was exposed. And all of a sudden, such a lust came over Rava that he ran home and had a nooner with his wife. This is in the Talmud. And she wanted to know, what all of a sudden is this? And then he had to explain, and she got very upset at Abaye's wife. But here was a perfect example that sometimes some of the things that occur to us at work, on the street, and so on can be very helpful in terms of arousal, but then it's about being able to bring it home and not letting it pull one outside of the marital
relationship. And is the moral of the story that it's okay to bring it home, or that it's upsetting to bring it home?
No, I think that the moral is that it's okay and appropriate to bring it home. I think that the question would be, how much should one be seeking that out? And that, I think, is an interesting question. Like, if one works with an attractive woman, or, for example, I'm speaking from the man's perspective.
Right.
We can reverse it.
Yeah. We women can appreciate attractive women.
should one, actually try to have more opportunities to interact with her because he finds that that's arousing and that'll spice up his sex life with his wife? Or is that something that we should be concerned might turn into something problematic?
I feel like that's a subject for another podcast.
I mean, or should the aim be that couples work together to find something that arouses them, and it's not just that it's Rava being aroused by someone and running home to his wife who gets upset, but couples should find something together that arouses both of them, and that way they are on the same page, and there isn't one person questioning how the other person got there.
So I think that that's a great point, and it gets us to the issue about making this part of the conversation, not just what's going on to a person's head. Maybe partly it's role play, which needs both people playing a role, but it also makes it that this is part of strengthening the relationship or having a positive, satisfying sexual relationship and not a type of a fantasy that is pulling one away from the relationship. So I think the idea of bringing it explicitly into one's conversation with one's spouse, unless you're afraid it might freak them out or other things, I think could be very healthy and appropriate, certainly very appropriate from a halachic perspective.
Doves, whose arm was exposed in that Gemara?
That was Abaye's wife.
Right. So maybe it was the message that Rava's wife should think about exposing her arm a little bit more when Rava comes, or Rava's wife should think about exposing her arm more when mm-hmm. Rava comes home for lunch.
Fair point, very well taken.
Rape fantasy is a major topic that's sometimes associated with porn culture, but it's definitely something that's getting discussed more and more these days. While many enjoy rape fantasy, it certainly draws criticism. And it can be risky and blur the lines of saying no and meaning no, or not actually meaning no, but of people understanding the no. Dr. Marcus, can you explain a little bit what rape fantasy is? How common is it?
So Rami, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I feel like this is one of the most misunderstood elements of fantasizing. Rape fantasies have no relationship to rape. Period. End of story. Like, I always say this to women, because women often feel one of the problems with getting women to learn how to fantasize is they often edit their fantasies, feel like, oh my God, my fantasies aren't PC, and I'm fantasizing about women, and now I'm fantasizing about being overtaken by some guy, and how un-PC is that? And my feeling is, and I always sort of amused when I go through this with a woman, let's look at that rape fantasy, okay? You're fantasizing about being overpowered by somebody, yet you have created the man. You have told him when to start. You have told him what to say to you. You have decided what he looks like and exactly what he does to you. And you're going to tell him exactly when to stop doing what he's doing. So you are in 100% control of that fantasy. So for us to somehow mix fantasies of rape, in which case the woman is completely in control, I'm talking about women right now, versus real rape, which is a horrible thing, in which case women have completely given up any of their autonomy, they're totally different issues, and not one that I think should be limited by women. Classically, historically, being overpowered, being taken, are fantasies that have been very, very popular with women. Because they've become so un-PC recently, people can't write about them, that it looks a lot like that's where the vampire fantasies have all come from, because that kind of makes it kosher. The, you know, overtaking fantasies is kosher, because now he's like thinking about your blood. So I would say to women, the most important thing for women is to discern what really turns them on, to find out their erotic map, and to be able to live with that in their head and realize that has no resemblance to what they want to have happen in reality. Like, fantasies are a separate entity. And if women can do that, and men, I think everybody would end up with a much healthier sex life.
It seems that there's no connection, because a rape fantasy is planned. And that there's no connection, and controlled, and there's no connection between a rape fantasy and an actual rape, because
correct.
It's something that a couple discusses before they actually play it out.
Or
that's happening in her head.
Or his head, yes.
Rabbi Linzer, assuming that a rape fantasy is consensual, does it fall within the realm of halachic permissibility? Are there any problems with it?
Well, given what Dr. Marcus shared, I mean, the first question would be, you know, what are the implications about these fantasies in terms of a person's own behavior. So given what Dr. Marcus shared, I cannot see how this could create any problems. Halachically, it gets back to just imagining, and how the imagining can arouse oneself when one is having sex with one's spouse, which is totally appropriate. I would like to reflect on the case about the man having having rape fantasies, or about rape role play, because I wonder if the man is fantasizing that way, can it sometimes translate into him forcing himself on his wife, doing certain things, you know, while he's, as a result of the fantasy, and maybe while he's fantasizing, that she would not be wanting him to do? And, you know, what would be the effect of role playing rape? That lead to encourage, you know, that type of behavior?
I've never seen there be a correlation. In other words, when couples are playing out any kind of bondage or domination, which I think will be a great topic for another podcast, you know, sort of the rules are set up in advance. There's a safe word that you say when you don't want something to happen. And obviously, when you're role playing a rape or some kind of being overtaken or somebody climbing through the window and, you know, taking a woman or vice versa, that's all been discussed in advance. And I have never seen the situation that context get taken out of control. And I think in general as a society, we're so nervous about if you imagine something, then it will happen. Whereas in reality, the studies suggest the opposite. So, you know, in cultures where there's porn is more, is legalized, the incidence of rape and any kind of violent sexual behavior is much lower. So I have never seen that be the case. And I would think you'd have a hard case to make.
I think here's a good time to step back and reflect on the importance of rabbis knowing the facts and consulting with the right experts, because a person who's asked a halachic question might imagine that that does encourage such behavior. And again, it's really just critical to know those facts. The last thing I want to say about this is another, also a larger topic for another time, but the statement in the Talmud, again, from the man's perspective, anything a man wants to do with his wife, he can do, which really expresses an enormous latitude in terms of the sexual behavior between husband and wife. And the area that the Talmud really is concerned with is, again, not the types of activities that are being done, but whether it's about the couple caring for one another, connecting to one another, as opposed to using one another.
Thank you, Dr. Marcus and Rabbi Linzer, for your insights. I think that we've come to some very powerful conclusions about what is halachically permissible. We've talked about consensuality and about the vastness of halachic permissibility between a couple. And we should carry this conversation. And like you said, Dr. Marcus, there's a lot more to be discussed in future podcasts. Our guest for today is Michael Lesher, author of Sexual Abuse, Shonda, and Concealment in Orthodox Communities. Thank you for joining us at The Joy of Text, Michael.
Well, thank you for having me.
You write on such an important and difficult subject. In your book, you analyze how and why cases of sexual abuse have been systematically concealed in Orthodox Jewish communities. Can you tell us a bit about how you got into this?
Well, I got into it in large part because I'm an Orthodox Jew, and also because I have legal training. And when people began coming to me and asking me what to do about these issues, I went from being initially quite bewildered and stunned to feeling that I really had to do something to try to help. To some extent, that was writing in the form of freelance journalism, and sometimes it was helping where I could with legal work, which I've done a lot of now. And then I ultimately felt this had to be put into a book. I had to put what I knew into some kind of tangible form.
Michael, do you feel like this is a problem that's more significant in the Orthodox community than in the general population at large? Less significant, sort of the same, covered up differently? Like, can you just give us a few senses of comparison to how you feel like it, you know, how this problem manifests itself in the Orthodox community versus the non-Orthodox Jewish community?
Well, to give a short answer, as far as I know or anyone else knows, there's no more sexual abuse in Orthodox Jewish communities than elsewhere, and it wouldn't seem to me very likely that it would be greater. For that matter, it doesn't seem to me terribly likely that the rates would be much, any particularly less either. But what we do have, partly because we are, after all, a religious community in which individuals are supposed to be responsible for one another, and partly because we have communal institutions that unfortunately do not have a good record of helping victims of these crimes, we do have a particular problem that we have to work with. It's not unique, but it is something that is that is peculiar to the ways that Orthodox Jewish institutions have developed over time and the way they have reacted to sex abuse problems when they begin to appear.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this difference, the sweeping under the rug that happens in these communities?
Yes, I'm certainly not needed to tell that. We know that that's been a problem. What I tried to do in my book was to analyze just how it happens, and as much as I can to try to illustrate why it happens. There are particular forces in our community that tend to militate against victims of sex abuse being able to come forward and seek justice. One is that the community worries very much about its public image. Another is that complaints traditionally tend to be funneled toward rabbinic courts. And these are institutions where what is most important is the preservation of the status quo, the preservation of rabbinic authority, and the preservation of an image of the community in a way that the community feels is necessary for its well-being. All these things tend to work against abuse victims.
This is Dov Linzer talking. As a member of the modern Orthodox community, when we hear these things, we tend to say, well, these are problems in the Haredi community, the ultra-Orthodox community. It's not a problem for us. I don't believe that's true, but I'm wondering what your work shows about that.
I agree with you. I don't think this is a problem limited to the right-wing or Haredi branches of Orthodox Judaism. I won't say in all respects all these branches are identical in the way they handle them. In the more modern Orthodox communities, there are more people who are prepared to go to secular authorities, more people who are prepared to resist rabbinic pressures to conceal these cases. But we know of plenty of cases within modern Orthodox communities that have been handled in very similar fashion. The case that first brought this largely to public attention was that of Baruch Lanner, and the stories continue to emerge in all aspects of Orthodox life.
Why are parents not teaching their kids to come forward in these communities? Victim blaming and victim threatening in such communities is a major part of this systematic concealment. But why is this the case? Don't parents want to protect their children?
Parents want very, very much to protect their children, but they are often subject to pressures from different directions, which make what protecting the child is a complicated question for them. I can tell you, for example, one of the first cases that I studied in great detail was the case of Avraham Mandrowitz, who fled the country at the end of 1984, is still living in Israel and still under indictment on, I think it's 8 counts of first-degree child abuse, 5 counts of first-degree sodomy, and so on. He is believed to have abused dozens, perhaps hundreds of kids. And the parents of those victims that I spoke to, almost without exception, told me that, first of all, they didn't realize that there were other victims because nobody had told them that. And second, they were afraid that if what had happened to their children became public, that this would injure the children more than trying to bring an escaped felon to justice. They were afraid the children wouldn't be able to get married, that they would remain under a stigma. And so they thought they were doing the best they could by trying to keep them out of the public eye.
Is there also an element of the parents having a little trouble believing this about some of these rabbinic figures who they adore and revere?
In some cases, the victims were not believed by their parents. In other cases, they were, or sometimes they came to believe them later. One mother that I spoke to never really doubted her child, but did think that she was doing the right thing by not reporting it. She felt very bad about it afterwards. But at the time, in the 1980s, she really didn't know that she had an alternative. But I did talk to one victim who told me straight out that when he first told his father what Mandrowitz had done to him, Mandrowitz falsely claiming to be a rabbi, falsely claiming to be a psychologist, but he believed he was both, he became rather angry and said, just don't tell me such a thing. That can't be. And that's not an unusual story.
You have said that there can be, and I quote, there can be no legitimate role for the rabbinical court in any sex abuse investigation. And I want to push you on this and ask, why is that the case? Can't the role of the rabbinical court to be expose such cases instead of concealing them?
Well, I'm not the only one saying that. There are other people like Rabbi Yosef Blau who's been stressing that point. And the reasons for it are really pretty straightforward. Rabbinic court doesn't have either the expertise or the authority to handle a case of sex abuse, which is, after all, a criminal case, in the way that justice would demand it be handled. The most they could really do is act as a kind of gatekeeper, a way station on the way to secular authorities. And even in that role, their options are so limited as not to really amount to any a legitimate role at all. Either they have no effect, or they have the effect of interfering with and impeding the justice process, and they shouldn't be doing either.
Do you think that the fact that we have an all-male rabbinate somehow plays a role in this?
That's a very interesting question. You know, I don't know if simply having women in the rabbinate would make a difference or would have made a difference, but I can't help wondering if the fact of having an all-male authority system is connected to the kind of thinking that, to some extent, has conceptualized sex abuse and sexual issues in a rather limited way. I mean, some of these examples are pretty notorious, I mean, pretty shocking, really, to talk about, as when it was alleged that a very prominent Orthodox rabbi insisted that sex abuse cases had to be abandoned if the victims hadn't actually been sexually penetrated. There are other cases like that. Just recently, there was a case in England where the defense that was made on behalf of a man who had a long-term sexual relationship with a girl, I think she was 15 and 16 years old when it took place, and the defense offered by a prominent rabbi was, well, in halacha, there's really no big difference between a girl that age and an adult, so it's not really such an offense. That may be a long answer to your question, but I think that if we conceptualize sex abuse terms more from the point of view of the victim, we wouldn't be saying things like that, making rationalizations like that. And the fact that we don't conceptualize them from the point of view of the victim has something to do, I think, with the patriarchal traditions that the rabbinate has to some extent.
I want to jump in as a woman who's training to join the clergy and get ordained and say that the role of women should not be there as strictly moral. And I think that that kind of lets men off the hook. So let's put a woman in place so men don't really have to be on their A game. And so men don't really have to act accordingly. Yes, it is important that women have a place there. It's important for the victims. It's important for really everyone. But at the same time, I think that the conversation maybe needs to be shifted a little bit more to not how can we supplement for what's lacking with these rabbis who aren't reporting it, but how can we educate kids to come forward? How can we change the dynamic in communities so that the rabbinical courts are not just protecting these people, but are actually speaking out against them?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, so one of the things that I'm curious about is you had said that you don't think that there's such a difference between, let's say, the more Haredi or right-wing Orthodox communities and the more modern Orthodox communities. And clearly this is a problem in all elements of the community. But I guess as a sex therapist, I come from the perspective that in general, the more restrictive and limited and non-discussed sex is, the more it creates a petri dish for sexual abuse. And therefore, I would wonder if there wouldn't be more sexual abuse in those communities.
Well, Dr. Marcus, last year, just a quick plug for the YCT week that Maharat does together. Last year, we did a whole week on abuse and sexual abuse and physical abuse. And one of the women who was presenting told us this story of a little girl who was in an ultra-Orthodox school who told her mother that she went to the rabbi's office and he touched her hair. And she was very uncomfortable that the rabbi had touched her hair. And the mother said, "Don't worry about it. What's the big deal? He just touched your hair." She came forward to her mother and her mother reported it. The rabbi basically denied it. But the rabbi never touched her again. And then it came out years later that the rabbi actually was touching girls, and he was using that as a way to test girls. First he touched their hair, then he touched their shoulder, and then it would become more and more serious every time. And I think that, first of all, it's inspiring that this girl spoke out because her mother didn't believe her and she wasn't encouraged to speak out. She was actually shut down when she did. But I wonder how common it is that girls are actually speaking out to their parents and their parents are either shutting them down or not believing it, and whether that is it's a possible shift in culture or if there's any hope for this getting better.
When I speak of these problems being distributed through the Orthodox community, the problem I had in mind was particularly how they're handled once they appear, how the institutions that cover up these abuses tend to work. And unfortunately, we've seen that on the religious left and the religious right. But if we can take advantage of some of the ideas that are perhaps more accessible to the modern end of the community and starts thinking of sexuality not simply as something to ward off, but something, the aspects of which can be embraced and something which can be healthy and productive and can involve teaching children about what is wrong, not what's wrong for them to do, but what's wrong to be done to them as well, then I think we're moving on the right path. We have to instill in all of us, but especially in our children, we want to try to instill in them a healthy notion of sexuality. Sexuality as part of one's personal integrity. Sexuality as an expression of love. Sexuality even as a connection to divine pleasures. And when you can do that, you're taking a big step toward leading children in a direction where they're likely to know their own right to protect themselves. You're not going to stop all abuse that way, but you're going to cut a lot of the ground out from under the abuser and what you might call abuse culture.
In a sentence or two, what would you want listeners to come away with? What can we start to do about this problem?
Well, the first thing we really have to do is to acknowledge it. It's not a pleasant thing to acknowledge, but without acknowledging it, we remain powerless to stop it. Once we know the truth, we are stronger, and once we're stronger, we can take action. These are not insoluble problems, and I think we have the resources as individuals and as an outgrowth of religious tradition to do something about these things and bring us all in the right direction.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
To read more of Michael Lesher's important commentary on sexual abuse in the Orthodox community, feel free to check out his book, Sexual Abuse, Shonda, and Concealment in the Orthodox Communities, available on Amazon and in ebook. Up next, Rabbi Linzer and Dr. Marcus tackle your questions. Thank you to everyone who wrote in with questions. If you want to submit a question anonymously, please go to thejoyoftext.org. Our first question is, my best friend gave me Kama Sutra cards for my anniversary. Can we use them?
How about if I to go first with this, Dov. Okay. So I'm not going to answer, can we use them? But let me just say something about Kama Sutra cards. So I am guessing from the packs I've seen, there must be a lot of different kind of packs of Kama Sutra cards. But for the most part, the Kama Sutra deals with positions. So I am going to guess that that stack of cards has a bunch of different positions. So right before Dov talks halachically about it, I'll just say be careful because you could really pull your back out or strain your neck. Some of those positions are insane, and do not feel like just because it's in the Kama Sutra pack means you should try it.
Best tried after an hour of yoga.
Exactly.
So thank you. This is actually a perfect place to bring in, again, that Talmud from passage from Nedarim that states that, again, from the man's perspective, anything a man wants to do with his wife, he may do. That after going through a large discussion of certain positions that may or may not be appropriate, the concluding voice in the Talmud is that positions don't matter. Whatever works for you as a couple. Another possibility could be, that the cards are maybe a type of a soft pornography, and is that something that's problematic? And the other issue is, like, is this a vehicle for bringing in the values of another culture that would somehow not be appropriate within a Jewish context. So as far as the first issue is concerned, I think we're back to our earlier conversation.
Can I ask what those values would be? Would the value be the different positions, or would the value be looking at the cards and
using
those pornographic
images? No, I think that the
value,
I'm sorry for speaking over you. I think that the concern would be the value of type of a indulging in sensuality that maybe is somehow communicated through that card or that they emerge from. So, and that might be it might be seen as problematic as a vehicle for bringing in that type of more sex-indulgent or sensuality-indulgent type of a culture. I'm really mischaracterizing. Let me step back and say, I really don't know enough about the culture that from which Kama Sutra emerges and Indian culture. So I'm not saying whether this is an accurate characterization or not, but I could see how some people could have that concern. So as far as the first issue is concerned, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is things that are arousing and stimulating and are done as part of the couple's sex life is totally acceptable. The issue about pornography and if that presents a special problem, I think that's something to speak about in another time. We'll bracket that for now.
I just want to add about the Kama Sutra that in the broadest context, the Kama Sutra really is just trying to talk about sex being spiritual in addition to being physical. Mm. And so if we're not worried that it came from another culture, the message is actually probably a message that jives quite well with the Jewish ethos of godliness, spirituality, sex. They all kind of work in a jumble together.
That's really fascinating, because do you feel that some of those values are communicated through the cards?
Absolutely not. You just see really weird pictures, and usually they're not that erotic either. They've uh-huh. got like, you know, usually they're just, you know, silhouettes of uh-huh. people. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But that the idea of the Kama Sutra is like there's positions where they have you facing each other and looking each other, gazing each other's eyes, mm. you know, clasping hands. Because the idea is that sex is not just about the physical release of an orgasm, but an emotional and spiritual connection.
So, again, another perfect example about why rabbis have to be better informed and consult the experts. So, and if that way, it sounds actually like much more helpful than other types of things that are in our culture, the Western culture, that people could be drawing on to for arousal that do not communicate those values. One other point that I will make is that things that are done for utilitarian purposes, normally we're not concerned about the culture from which they emerge. The Talmud says that a person can even study practices of idolatry if they're doing it for the purpose of teaching or understanding it better. So certainly it would seem that something that is helping somebody in their sex life, we don't have to be concerned about the culture from which it emerges. And certainly with what Batsheva shared with us, it seems like it even is, you know, highly appropriate for a Jewish context and a Jewish marriage.
Thank you. Our next question is, can one fulfill the mitzvah of onah, or pleasing one's wife, through the use of a vibrator?
So I guess I'll start this one. Thank you again, Rami. So let's first define some terms. You translated onah as pleasing one's wife. Onah is a mitzvah in the Torah that the rabbis understand is requiring a husband to have sex at regular times with his wife. Another aspect of that mitzvah is to have sex with his wife when she wants to be having sex and when she desires sex with her husband. Now, that is normally understood to be intercourse. So, and that's where the question emerges from about the use of a vibrator. So here we need a couple of important clarifications. First of all, the act of intercourse by itself is not a fulfillment of the mitzvah of onah. And this gets to your phrase of pleasing one's wife. The Talmud, again, all of this we should repeat, is from the male perspective. So what would that mean in the reverse? We could talk about. But anyway, moving on. So the Talmud consistently refers to a mitzvah l'sameach et ishto, which literally translated would be to bring joy to one's wife, but one might say to bring pleasure, satisfaction to one's wife. And it speaks about the mitzvah of simchas onah, the pleasure of ona, and very much identifies it not as just the physical act, but the fact that it is satisfying the woman sexually. And because of that, there's no question that all other aspects of foreplay and sexual touch and everything that goes on that provides increased sexual satisfaction is part of the mitzvah of ona. Even the Stipler Rav, in a famous letter that he wrote about the mitzvah of ona, says that these are part and parcel of that mitzvah.
He says even Yom Kippur can't atone for robbing your wife of not performing onah.
Thank you. Exactly. And he makes the point that, you know, shouldn't be treated as any different from any other mitzvah. If we adopt a lot of stringencies about matzah and our lulav and esrog, then we should be just as stringent about the mitzvah of onah, which doesn't mean restricting things. Stringency about the mitzvah of onah means doing everything that's possible, whether it's positions, whether it's fantasies, whether it's use of a vibrator, to ensure that the woman is being sexually satisfied. Again, this focuses on the woman. The man's satisfaction is also important, but that's how this mitzvah is phrased. So the one question that we're left with is, what about if the woman is sexually satisfied, but no intercourse took place? Would that actually be the mitzvah of onah? And here it seems that the answer from a technical standpoint is no, because in addition to the woman's sexual satisfaction, there's an aspect which is just the physical coming together of husband and wife. Could be, doesn't have to be vaginal, could be anal sex, but still that sense of actual what the Gemara calls kiruv basar, their flesh coming together, their being as one. So it does seem that that is technically necessary, although at some level I would say, what difference does it make? If the woman isn't interested in actual intercourse and what she wants tonight is the vibrator, then there's no we don't have to worry about the mitzvah of ona. This is what the woman wants. And certainly to have intercourse when the woman isn't interested in it would be not only not a fulfillment of ona, but it would be a violation of halacha.
So, you talked about kiruv basar, right? So why does kiruv basar necessarily have to be that penis and the vagina?
Supposing also, is kiruv basar not, is it not a separate mitzvah from ona?
So to answer I want to stop
and go back because we just said a lot of Hebrew terms and we have to
Yes, you're right. Okay.
Okay. Rabbi Linzer, I want to ask on that. If a man uses a vibrator on his wife, does he not fulfill the mitzvah of ona, of pleasing her or satisfying her, if she doesn't necessarily want to have vaginal or anal intercourse? Dr. Marcus, you mentioned a great point that kiruv basar, the coming together of flesh, does that only have to happen through penetration? Can it not happen through using a vibrator and other forms of coming together as flesh?
So there's no question that the coming together of flesh does occur and should occur outside of actual intercourse. For example, Ramban says that if a couple, sort of the myth that people have, some people have about Jews, that they have sex through a sheet, the Ramban says if the couple or one of them wants to have sex while wearing pajamas, that actually is forbidden, and that's a violation of an aspect of the mitzvah of ona, because part of the mitzvah of ona is not just, again, not just intercourse, but here their bodies coming together, their naked bodies coming together. Similarly, the stipler in that letter we mentioned earlier says that after sex, the couple should lie together, you know, and
cuddle.
Cuddle. I think I was looking at the word spoon together, but okay. Oh, I'm a man. I don't. Anyway, fine.
I include that letter in all my Kala classes and tell my Kalas to go take it home and show their fiance right when they get back. This is what the stipler says.
All right. So clearly, that's an aspect that exists independent of the actual act of intercourse. All of that being said, and it's not like I wouldn't want to agree with you, because if it's all about the coming together of the flesh and it's all about the wife's satisfaction and a man doesn't fulfill the mitzvah if his wife isn't satisfied, then why is the actual act of intercourse necessary? And I think that a big problem that we have, maybe in larger culture, but certainly within Orthodoxy, is that we somehow have defined sex to be just about intercourse. Couples that that are following halacha and not having sex before they're married, they don't have a history and an experience of sexual activity that's not about intercourse. They go right into intercourse, and that really limits their palate and their repertoire. So I think it is a big problem if we the hyper focus on intercourse, but I think that that's the halacha.
But Dov, I feel like you're begging the question here, because basically ona is what a man is responsible to give the woman and have sex with her when she wants.
Right.
So if she doesn't want to have intercourse and what she wants to have is X or Y or any kind of stimulation other than intercourse, then it's silly to say, well, is he giving her ona or not giving her ona? Because clearly he's responding to what she wants.
You just underlined how problematic it is to define sex as intercourse,
I'm even saying defining ona that way becomes... maybe he's not doing ona, but... Ona saying that he's giving her what she wants. So if she wants is something other than ona, quote unquote, tonight, then that's fine. So it's sort of, we've come in a full circle.
So I fully agree with that. And that's what I was getting at earlier. So let me repeat what I said, what I was trying to say then, if I wasn't being clear. When I said, okay, maybe it's not ona, but what difference does it make? What I was getting at is exactly that there's no mitzvah of ona if she doesn't want to be having intercourse. So if she's not interested in intercourse, it's a moot question whether he fulfills the mitzvah of ona, because then there's no mitzvah of ona right now.
Exactly.
So all it really is a... So more of a theoretical discussion. It doesn't have any practical ramifications. The man is supposed to be responsive to his wife's sexual needs, and that's even if they're not having sex, he has to be responsive to her sexual needs and engage in sexual activity, and that certainly emerges from certain discussions in the laws of Nida when a husband is leaving and maybe he isn't able to have sex with his wife. He's leaving on a journey, but he has to have sexual activity with her. Again, here sex being defined as intercourse. He can't have intercourse with his wife, but he could still have sexual activity. So clearly, there's an obligation to be responsive to those needs. And clearly, there's not only no mitzvah to have intercourse if the woman doesn't want, but it's forbidden to have intercourse if the woman doesn't want. So it's really practically, it's really a moot question, but in principle, and this is, I think, we should acknowledge, it becomes a challenge in terms of people that are, like, have a halachic mindset. You know, the fact that technically the mitzvah is defined as intercourse with all of these things, you know, that is, I think, in principle the case, and that does lead to a hyper-focus on intercourse.
Islander, you've mentioned, not tonight, but I've heard you mention that this question, the idea of coming through a vibrator could actually elevate the use of a vibrator from a heter or something that's permissible to actually a mitzvah, something that we should be doing, a positive commandment.
Absolutely. I think that following the Stipler, a vibrator is a good chumra in the mitzvah of ona. I think that as, I am sure Dr. Marcus will tell you, a very high percentage of women really can only achieve orgasm through clitoral stimulation and not through vaginal stimulation. And if the mitzvah is to make sure that the man to make sure that his wife is sexually satisfied, then the vibrator is a great way to be fulfilling the mitzvah.
And I would just like to point out that they probably didn't have vibrators in the time of the Gemara, so there probably wasn't a lot of comment on it.
Exactly.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask questions anonymously or respond to these questions, go to thejoyoftext.org. Please submit your specific questions, as specific as possible, without giving away your identity. Thank you to Rabbi Dov Linzer and Dr. Batsheva Marcus. Our producer for this episode was David Zvi Kalman, and the show was recorded by Mike Hurst. The Joy of Text is recorded in New York City. My name is Rami Smith. Thank you for listening.
The Joy of Text is a production of Jewish Public Media. You can listen to this show on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcast app. Be sure to check out our other shows like Responsa Radio and Talking in Shul at jpmedia.co.